Direct from the edge of the lunatic fringe, it's the Raleigh James Show.
Raleigh James Show with, as usual, a lot of things on my mind. First, we want to wish Soroya get well wishes. She's illin' tonight and under the weather, and we'll catch us on the replay. And we'll put her on our prayer request, that's for sure. I just read the House alternative to Obamacare, the Republican alternative to Obamacare. And once again, I can prove they're Republicrats and Demopublicans. There's not a nickel's worth of difference here. And, you know, if you want to know where we're going, we've got so many instructive things worldwide to tell us. You know, when we talk about Obamacare, we can reference the NHS in Great Britain and see exactly what socialized medicine will do for us. Just give it 20 years, or Canada's system, for instance. Well, very few people look at South Africa and realize that this, too, is an instructive example in terms of where we are now and where we might soon be. And so Carl, who listens in New York regularly, suggested we talk to Dr. Dan Root. And I looked at his Prague.org. It's Praag.org. I will have a link on Raleigh.net to that. And I looked at some of his other writings and some of the battles that he has fought and thought it would be perfect to talk to Dan. So, Dan, welcome to the Raleigh James Show.
Good evening, Raleigh. Thank you very much for having me.
What time is it in South Africa?
Well, it's now 4 in the morning.
I was afraid
of about
that.
6 hours ahead of you of New York time.
Yeah, I was afraid of that. But thank you for being a patriot and spreading the message worldwide. You know, it's interesting. South Africa rarely comes up in the news here. And when it does, invariably it has been about Mandela and the joyous celebration that South Africa has been liberated. And, you know, I don't think there's a free-thinking person alive who wants any class of people to be kept down. So the idea that there is equality across the land sounds appropriate, sounds like a wrong has been finally righted. The problem is, as we look further, this is not about that. Much like many of the things that happen here, it is how it's portrayed, but what's actually happening, near as I can tell, is damn near a Marxist takeover. So now you're there. What's going on?
Yes, you're quite right. I call it, you know, Leninism almost, because, you know, Lenin had this concept of democratic centralism.
Mm-hmm.
Now, South Africa is a very multicultural and even multi-ethnic society. We've got about 11 different official languages, but power has been concentrated in the hands of a few, and the entire system is set up in such a way, that it's centered, that power is centralized, and Parliament, what you call the Congress, down in Cape Town, is just a rubber stamp for the ruling party. So, in effect, if you belong to an ethnic minority like we do, you're actually disenfranchised. I mean, we've got the vote, but you can vote until you blue in the face, but you won't be able to influence the political process because you just don't have the numbers to get people into power.
Right, and what we see, it's almost as if there's a cosmic pendulum where at one point there was a group of people who were disenfranchised, not entirely, not the way the world likes to portray it, but certainly there were separate systems and there was certainly segregation and differences depending upon your race. But rather than correct that in any way with equality to all, the pendulum has swung the other way, and now Afrikaners or Caucasians in the minority are basically being, from what I understand, frozen out of the system.
Yes, exactly. We've got now more legislation, you know, against Caucasians or whites, as you say, than we had before, you know, restricting blacks from trading in certain areas and so on. But of course, the old system was much more complicated than that, and there were some areas of the country run by blacks and where they could trade freely and rule themselves, and even municipalities where they could rule themselves. Whereas now, you know, outside the province of the Western Cape, there is not a single municipality where we actually have any say whatsoever in the spending of even our local taxes. So we have been effectively excluded from government. And, you know, there are such strict affirmative action laws now in South Africa that you're not allowed to even own a business unless you have some kind of a black partner. This is called black economic empowerment. And you are almost, you're forced actually to have some sort of a black partner just to register a business. And your access to capital, even loans, is restricted as a white person. Yes, so this system is actually far worse than traditional segregation.
And what's happened here again is it's sold to the world as equality. It's sold in the classic sense. It's sold to the world as freedom. It's sold to the world as finally we're seeing everybody be able to have an equal shot. And as you well know, Dan, you can't legislate equality. You can legislate that everybody should have an equal shot at the apple, for instance. But the problem is that instead of correcting the wrongs and doing that, erasing these lines, making it colorblind, they've swung in the other direction for a variety of reasons to a point where if you are white in South Africa right now, the word genocide is not foreign to your thoughts.
Yes, exactly. you know, as you say, the pendulum has swung right to the other side. And even when it comes to equality among blacks in South Africa, that doesn't hold either, because there's a very small group of highly privileged people who are connected to government and big business and so on,
mm-hmm.
who actually benefit from the system. But the mass of blacks are actually poorer now than ever before.
Mm-hmm. This, by the way, Dan, is exactly what I knew would happen, because we're not talking about equality for anyone here. In the name of quote-unquote equality, in the name of rising what had been the lower classes in terms of on the socioeconomic ladder, instead, it seems to me, like I say, classical communism, classical Marxism, where the ruling elite, the Mandela and his cadre, and the people who have come after him, who may be worse, they're living the life of Riley, and the average black person in South Africa, as you say, is worse than they ever were.
Yes, exactly. That is the case. But of course, we've got another, you know, apart from the economic dimension, we've got a cultural dimension in South Africa, and that has also got progressively worse, in that the two cultures, Western culture and African culture, have been mixed up, and you know, you no longer have any coherent value system left, and that leads to the most atrocious violence and breakdown of the social order, criminality, murder, rape, that kind of thing. So, you know, this is I call this a science fiction society, because we are living in a kind of horrific future where there's a complete lack of ethics and of human decency, and people are just getting attacked and killed, and every day. It's actually quite horrific. So the discrepancy between this promised utopia, people here refer to it as Mandela-topia, mm-hmm. you know, because it's associated so much with the figure of Nelson Mandela. The discrepancy between the Mandela-topia portrayed by the world media and the actual reality on the ground cannot be more stark.
And in a way, you could almost predict this. You don't have to be a psychic to know how this would go, because when groups of people have been kept down, regardless of their skin color or their origin or anything else, they have been in an impoverished state, and they are promised suddenly that life will be so much better. When it isn't, you lose faith in anything that would be considered the tendrils of society. What have you got to lose? And when you have that what have you got to lose mentality, it devolves to criminality instantly.
Yes, exactly. There is that problem of the rising expectations, but I see it more as more of a problem of a civilizational breakdown almost. And you also have the intense corruption throughout the whole system now, where even the police are corrupt. You've got about one quarter of policemen who actually have criminal records in South Africa. People write about this in the media and so on. And, you know, policemen can be on a murder charge, but he won't get fired or even suspended. I mean, there have been cases where policemen have committed armed robberies in full uniform, and then their guns would be taken away because they would be used as evidence in the case, but they would be reissued with other guns and be out on the streets within a few days, you know, still as policemen, while they are being tried on a murder or a robbery charge. So there's a complete absurdity at various levels of the system, and this leads to this type of breakdown.
Of course it does. And as you say that, people who don't think it can't happen here, it's happening here. Whether we question the birth certificate of a Barack Obama, for instance, because there's so many questions still remaining about that, or whether we look at what the IRS has been doing or so many other organizations where we have caught them red-handed in corruption, we may not be at the point where murderous cops are back on the beat the next day, although it wouldn't totally surprise anybody. So there are some parallel here that is truly, truly frightening. Now, the first thing when you talk about this and I think of the implications, I think to myself, well, if it were me, I'd get the hell out of Dodge. What percentage of people who had the wherewithal to leave have?
Well, I think about 20% have left and emigrated to various other Western countries. But, of course, there are also restrictions on our immigration. You know, ironically, probably if you're some sort of a third world refugee, you can easily get into another Western country. But as we are, you know, people who have been documented and, you know, we are just seen as just another Western person, we are subject to all sorts of restrictions regarding your age and your profession and so on. And it's actually very expensive for anyone to immigrate. So it's actually beyond the means of most people to leave and go to another country. So you find that most of us are actually stuck here, but we've been here for 3.5 centuries. So we've got a lot of roots here. You know, our language was standardized right here, Afrikaans, which is similar to Dutch, but with a completely different spelling and so on. So it's not at all that easy to actually immigrate. And the other question is, are we going from the frying pan to the fire, because we see what's happening in a lot of other Western countries where at least we realize what the problem is, but it seems in a lot of those countries they still don't know. So you might be going there and your children will be subject to exactly the same conditions as we are here.
Right, that's the thing that we talk about often, that there's nowhere to run. I'm jealous of our forefathers who could, say, come to the New World or go to South Africa or what have you, because today, we don't, unless we're tremendously wealthy, we don't have those kind of options. It may not be any better, which makes it frightening. Now, of course, it's more than just sociological and economic. I see the word genocide increasingly used in news articles. What is going on?
Yes, exactly. We had this youth leader of the ANC called Julius Malema, and a year or two ago, until there was a court case about that, he was singing "Killer Boer, Killer Farmer," and actually inciting young blacks to go out and kill whites. Now, he was stopped by a court order, and there was some sort of power struggle within the ruling party, and he was eventually booted out. But in fact, people are still singing that song informally without it being reported. And the violence that I was referring to before, which has a cultural basis in African culture, that is now just about rampant, because the police don't stop it. And you've got this kind of animus also created by the media and a lot of the liberal media, who still 20 years after the takeover by Mandela and these people, they still harp on the old apartheid days and the injustices of the past. They don't talk about the injustices of the present and the extreme violence and criminality. They talk about the injustices of 30 or 40 years ago. You know, it would be like in the U.S. Talking about Rosa Parks or Martin Luther King. That's all we hear about. We don't hear about the present, but simply about the past. And that creates this kind of psychosis for this violence to take place. And there's a definite sort of anti-white, anti-European, anti-Western type of a mentality here. That is also being maintained by the mainstream media, and that as the effect of facilitating these atrocities that are taking place every day, where entire families are massacred and elderly people, children are killed and so on. I mean, I follow a lot of these stories, and we publish them on our website as well, but it's actually horrific.
Well, it is horrific, and it is also, when you look at the press reportings, completely illogic. I would hope that everybody agrees that the past system was not perfect and probably not just and should not have stood. But what we have is a system now that is getting, not getting, that is worse for everybody concerned, other than the ruling elite. But it seems that anybody who speaks out against the present is labeled a racist and is supposed that, well, you wanted it the way it was. The idea that what you don't like now means that you're accepting of racism is something the press has been perpetrating, and we see that here. That's a direct commonality, and that is very worrisome to me, because so many things are ignored. In this country, a fella that we had on the air a while ago, Colin Flaherty, wrote a book, White Girl Bleed a Lot, about the rising of black-on-white crime in America. And story after story, when someone in the police department would say, yes, this was this attack was spurred because a group of black people disliked the white people, whatever, they're fired for admitting that. The news articles do not mention the race of the perpetrators. And the problem I have with all this, of course, is that this is a very small minority of people of any color. But if we ignore this and sweep it under the rug, it's doing a disservice to people of every color.
Yes, you're quite right. We have exactly the same type of a taboo in South Africa. You know, unfortunately, America is a great country, but we seem to have imported all of the worst customs from the United States, including this political correctness. regarding racial issues. And nowadays in South Africa, you're also not allowed to state the perpetrator of a crime, mm-hmm. or either the race of the perpetrator, unless he happens to be white. Then, you know, the media actually, they actually report that right. the murderer was white.
That's the exact same thing, Dan, verbatim the same thing that we have. And, of course, if police can't profile somebody with how they look, and that would include what color they are, it's pretty hard to round up the criminals. So they know they're just prohibited from saying anything. But, you know, it's interesting when you talk about importing the worst of America. I contend that America might be powerful, but what we're really looking at here is not America, but a global cabal that is controlling everybody. And it is happening to America as well. So the world saw Nelson Mandela, this great savior and unifier. What's the truth about this man?
Well, you know, he was not a savior by any means. You know, he sat in prison for 27 years, and he would have been let out earlier if he had renounced violence, but he refused to renounce violence, and in the meantime he had a bunch of people in London, you know, some of them were actually from Lithuania, or their parents were from Lithuania, and they were plotting all these terrorist acts in South Africa, placing bombs in restaurants and on the street and so on, and creating publicity for their movement. I mean, they had no popular support here whatsoever. So, in fact, Mandela and this gang of people from the South African Communist Party and the ANC, they staged some sort of a coup in South Africa in the early 90s because they eliminated the moderate black opposition through violence. They actually killed them and terrorized them through some of these horrific, you know, executions by means of, you know, placing a tire around somebody's neck full of petrol and igniting it and so on. I mean, hundreds of people were killed in that way in order to terrorize the population.
Yeah.
So they actually came to power through sheer terrorism. And now that they have power, you know, they're not going to relinquish it, even if in the unlikely event that they would be voted out, as we've seen in Zimbabwe, they would not actually relinquish power as a result. They would rig the elections in some other way. But what you're saying about this internationalist cabal,
mm-hmm.
You know, Alex Jones talks about the New World Order.
Right.
And I strongly feel that we are also victims of this New World Order. They simply, South Africa was a country it had its political problems and so on, but they were being solved. You know, I've read some of the stuff that came out of the 80s and so on, and there were some brilliant theses and, you know, academics writing theories and you know, seeing a future for South Africa as a federal state and with everybody given their due rights and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But all of that was swept under the carpet in favor of this centralized system, which gave power to a small minority that is actually pillaging this country. I mean, they're literally stealing from the public purse. They're estimated about a third of our budget just goes lost through corruption. So this internationalist group of people, and they are also, of course, involved in the business and in supplying services to government and, you know, involved in certain industries and the mining industry and so on. So, yes, you're quite right. We are victims of the same kind of system.
And the necklacing you talk about, which I think all of us have seen that on television, and that's about as horrific it gets. That's up there with chopping off people's limbs while they're still alive, and the kind of things that we think nobody in a civilized society even thinks of doing. The thing that shouldn't be lost, and you said it, is that their first target was moderate black opposition. So it wasn't just, we're going to get whitey at that point. It was, we're going to get our political opponents. We're going to get anybody who could rise to power who isn't us. And right there, that's chilling, especially when, if you look at it, that they sincerely wanted any form of freedom, they were presented the ability to have that freedom with a federalist system, which would have been like the United States used to be, a plural noun, an amalgamation of areas, each one governed according to their local needs. I can't think of a fairer system, and the idea that that was completely drowned out at the expense of many lives, including many black lives, should tell you exactly where it is. And so then the big question becomes, and I know you've had quite a bit of experience with this, Dan, the myth of the free press. These are things that normally you would think independent investigative journalists would be over this like whites on rice, but instead the press became spokespersons for the Mandela clan.
Yes, exactly. You know, we've got two major problems, I think, both in the United States and in South Africa, and those are the universities and, of course, the mainstream media. Now, the two are connected because the journalists are all trained in the universities, of course. You know, they do these courses in journalism and so on, and afterwards they end up at the newspapers and the TV channels and radio stations and so on. And here in South Africa, because it's a smaller society, you can actually follow this almost in real time as it happens, you know, how they actually brainwash some of these kids and then eventually place them in key positions elsewhere where they can spew this type of propaganda that they are engaged in. So even though theoretically we have free media, in practice, apart from the internet, it doesn't work that way. And they actually literally exclude certain issues from the media, and they exclude certain people as well. You know, I used to write a column in the One Sunday newspaper here, but at one point when I referred to these baby killings and baby rapes and so on that's taking place in South Africa, and that has actually got worse now, they actually cut my column off right there. You're not allowed to refer to those things. Then you are a racist. Even if you don't refer to the race of the perpetrators, everybody knows that, you know, as somebody once told me, white people must commit offenses like that too. It's just that nobody has heard of such a case. Everybody knows that these are horrific acts are perpetrated by black people, and therefore by simply referring to those, you are then labeled a racist and you are excluded from participation in the mainstream media.
And that, too, is the situation here. You know, what you're describing is even worse than most people's premises, because you are describing something that is endemic, top to bottom, and will exclude anyone who is talking out. So, excuse me, I look at this and I'm at the nowhere to turn, nowhere to hide, and I keep coming back to the fact that this could not have effectively happened like this across the board if there were not some global nameless, faceless orchestrators of this, as powerful as Mandela might be or others like him. The bottom line is this could not be taking place without some help. And, of course, that leads me to wonder about banking, and that's where we're going to pick it up. I have Dr. Dan Root with me. He's kind enough to spend 4 a.m. in the morning, the 4 to 5 a.m. hour in South Africa with us. Praag.org, praag.org. I will have links to you for that as well, and I'll get you links to another podcast, Don. Dan recently did on Mandela. So many places to go with this, and I've gotten my list. I have a feeling this is sounding eerily familiar to you, so I'm sure you do as well. So your thoughts are welcome at 610-640-6400.
It's the Raleigh James Show.
And I want to mention the Sea Crane Company a moment. You know, I'm always talking about CC Wi-Fi radio. The beauty of Wi-Fi radio is, unlike your local AM FM, where you'll get a handful of stations and maybe you'll find one you like and most likely you won't, the Wi-Fi radio takes all the streams that are online, puts them on a radio just like they were your local station, and now you've got, instead of 20 choices, 20,000 choices. And, you know, we're talking with Dr. Dan Root about South Africa. Well, you want to listen to South African radio? You can do that on Wi-Fi radio. You can look by genre, by location. It is all there. You want to hear it direct from the source, you'll get it. Now, you might say, well, I can listen to streams online. Oh, yeah, you can. You have to find them. And if you're listening in bed, isn't it cozy to snuggle up to that laptop or worse yet, that desktop? Well, with a Wi-Fi radio, just like a little transistor you've got by your bedside, it's got a clock, it's got an alarm, it's got a timer, it's got buttons and knobs. I like knobs. And it's got a remote control with 99 presets. You'll fill them up. I pretty much guarantee you. You'll get all the streams. You'll also get Live 365 if you're a serious subscriber. Maybe you've been listening to Art Bell these last few nights. Well, it's right there on Wi-Fi radio. The CC Wi-Fi is a great one to choose for a lot of reasons. For one thing, Bob Crane's company has the best customer service out there, unlike any other internet retailer. You call them, you reach them in the office in California, no operators are standing by, they talk to you directly, and they help you. Yeah, real customer service. So call them during business hours, and you'll see what I mean. 888-444-7993. That's 888-444-7993. Or go online, seacrane.com. You can get a link right there on raleigh.net, seacrane.com. Now, whatever you order, and there's so much from which to choose, I'll tell you what, if you put James in the coupon code, or if you tell them James, if you're on the phone when you're ordering, you get 5% off your entire order. So you'll save money, too. It really is terrific. The Sea Crane Company, and you tell them Raleigh sent you. Get yourself a Wi-Fi radio. You'll like it. Now, the other thing I wanted to mention, it was recently brought to my attention, and I'm glad it was, that a lot of you don't know that on the front page of Raleigh.net, there is a link to Amazon. This does not change the price on anything. Whatever great deal you would get, you'll get, no matter what you're shopping for, anytime. But the show gets a small percentage of your order. So that's a plug for me there. But I thought everybody was aware of that and recently found out that, no, not everybody is. So every little bit helps. I'll tell you what, because as Dan Root knows firsthand, there's absolutely no money in spreading the truth. And we'll get to that story, too. And take your call, 610-640-6400.
Confusion, baby.
Right to the
left. Confusion, baby. Confusion. Confusion, baby. Confusion, baby. Confusion. Heaven help the man who is confused. Confused as I.
Right to the max. The Raleigh James Show. Call Raleigh now at 888-876-5593. 8888 Raleigh.
Yeah, that word I cut off was paranoid to the max. And yes, many people would say that. And to quote Lee Dorsey, confusion, baby. I guess so. The confusion between what you read and what is happening. And that type of a situation has to be systemic. We talk about it as what's going on in America, but if you want to see where it's heading, just look to South Africa. Dan Root, Dr. Dan Root, is joining us and giving us the real lowdown. I will get to your calls, 610-640-6400. But, Dan, I have to wonder about things like the central bank and all the cash infusion, and also what are the resources that the world bankers would like to control?
Well, you know, South Africa is probably the country with the second most, resources under our, mineral resources in the world after Russia. So, we've got still a tremendous amount of platinum and chrome and so on that has not been mined in this country. So over the last more than 100 years, this has been the bone of contention, and there have been international bankers and capitalists and so on who have wanted to control this resource. I actually had two interesting conversations with one of the last presidents of South Africa under the old system, Mr. P.W. Botha, who was a great patriot. And, in one of our conversations, he told me that the people of this country have never controlled the mineral wealth. And he was quite right. It's always been controlled from abroad or otherwise by people inside the country who are not, in the first instance, South Africans or, patriotic people of the soil, but who have international links and who are part of this global cabal, as you referred to it previously. So that is our problem. And, of course, they are also very influential in the media. They also have a lot of media interests, and they actually determine what the ordinary man in the street thinks, and he's completely hoodwinked in not actually knowing how our country is being manipulated and controlled and its resources actually being stolen by some of these people. So, yes, that's our problem.
It's a big one. Now, I assume there is a central bank, much like our Federal Reserve.
Yes, exactly.
And that... that central bank, do they answer to the Bank of International Settlements in Switzerland as we do?
Yes, exactly. And, I don't follow it all that closely, but I just picked up a few weeks ago that, for example, one of our bond issues or a few of our international bond issues are being... actually handled by Goldman Sachs. Now, if you know what Goldman Sachs did to Greece, for example.
Yes.
Part of the Greek problem arose out of the fact that Goldman Sachs did some very arcane or dodgy derivative deals with them. And, Goldman Sachs also in South Africa and working very closely with our central bank. And... Ms. Jill Marcus, who is the central bank governor. Now, before there was a black central bank governor, Mr. Tito Mboweni. But now I've asked myself, how does a white person like Ms. Jill Marcus become governor of our central bank when there's affirmative action everywhere in South Africa? it just looks very odd.
It isn't decided,
though. My only explanation can be that she is also well-connected to the globalist order.
Right, the banking conspiracy, if you will. And, this absolutely exists. And the interesting thing and the frustrating thing is a lot of people want to pinpoint it and say that, for instance, it's the Jewish banking conspiracy. The reality is that religion doesn't matter. This is a banking conspiracy that is on a higher order than any of the distractions that we get into bickering about. And their control is absolute I'm not the least bit surprised that an insider is running it, as is always the case here. Our Ben Bernanke used to work for the Bank of International Settlements. So it's not lost on me. And you mentioned Greece. Of course, the derivative deals, we look at what's happening right now in Syria, and you can't tell me that the currency used for the oil isn't part of this explosion. I would assume that's the same thing with regard to South Africa. And not only Greece, but now Poland, in the last week or so, we hear about one after another, these countries are being decimated. And I have to think, I'll be the conspiratorialist here, I have to think that there's a global governing that starts and ends with money.
Exactly. These people are, as you say, they are everywhere. They're very well connected. I mean, they actually meet at all these international events, stuff like the World Economic Forum and so on, and it's a very small group of people. And there they decide what to do. We also know about the so-called Bilderberg group that also meets up once a year. In South Africa, you know, the banking fraternity is also extremely small and closely knit.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then, of course, you've got, for a long time internationally, the diamond industry there.
Yes, exactly. South Africa, of course, the De Beers so-called cartel, diamond cartel, came about in South Africa. They also played a very big role in fomenting the Anglo-Boer War more than 100 years ago. And they've also been actively involved in media and other industries in South Africa. Mm-hmm. Some people say that they decided to bring the old government to a fall. They switched allegiance at some point. And for that reason, the ANC came to power. And they are not at all, really committed to this country. A lot of them live in London or in the United States. It doesn't take much for them to emigrate from one country to the next. And to this day, the Oppenheimer family is about the richest or the second richest family in South Africa, with the global connections to Switzerland and other places, to the entire diamond and luxury goods industry.
Well, if you want to control, it's much easier to control a small cabal of corrupt individuals at the top, like Mandela and his ilk, than it is somebody who is advocating federalism. So it's pretty easy to see why this happens. It's also pretty easy to see why the people would have gone along with it initially. Certainly when you're promised all the things that they were, and when you're coming from a system that's inherently not entirely fair to begin with, it's one of those seductive siren songs. But now, it seems to me, Dan, that most people are very well aware they've been had.
Yes, very much so, because I always say that, we've got more riots now than we ever had under the old system. Not a day goes by in South Africa when there's not some sort of a protest or riot going on. Now, you would think that people who are supposedly democratically represented in parliament and in the municipalities and so on, that they would simply pick up the phone and phone their local representative or their member of parliament to sort out the problem. But no. I mean, these people are protesting and rioting every day, with the difference being that and now it is no longer seen as a systemic crisis. When there were riots, say, in the mid-80s in South Africa, all the foreign journalists and, the New York Times, Washington Post, and so on, the BBC and CBS, they were all reporting on this stuff as a systemic political crisis in South Africa. Today we have even worse riots, yet nobody is reporting on that. And neither is it being seen as some sort of a crisis. It's just seen as, oh, well, there's just another riot, and we don't know exactly why. But it is because, the government is actually not doing what it's supposed to do, and it's not actually not looking after its constituents. It's looking after the people who are pillaging the country and benefiting from the system and from the systemic corruption of South Africa.
Right, which is the explanation for every communist regime and why they fail worldwide. I got more questions, but Carl wants to join in. So, Carl in New York, welcome.
Hey, how you doing, Raleigh? Hi, Dan. Yeah, I've been to South Africa, I guess, three times over the course of the last, maybe 15 years or so. First time I was there, whites were 12% of the population. Second time I was there, they were 11% of the population. Last time I was there, and I remember it was one Zuma who was elected, as a matter of fact. I happened to be in South Africa, Jacob Zuma. And the big controversy was which of his seven wives was going to be first lady. But at that time, they were 10% of the population. Now they're 9.6% of the population. And, you know, a lot of that decline in that number is murder and people sending their children out of the country. And I assume you were mentioned many times in Alana Mercer's book, Dan, Into the Cannibal's Pot, and so was Colin Flaherty, for that matter. But she points out that not only is South Africa, or was South Africa, intentionally deconstructed by this unknown force. I mean, we throw around these names, the Bilderbergers, the CFR. But, you know, Dan, you alluded to the fact that what we really need to know is the names of these people, you know, who are doing this. But that deconstruction is happening here, and it's happening in Europe. You know, essentially, wherever Caucasians are, that's what's being deconstructed.
Yes, exactly. You know, what the main conspiracists here were people like, Joe Slovo, who was the leader of the Communist Party. He became a member of the Communist Party at the age of 16. He wasn't actually born in this country. He was born in Lithuania, and he led this whole thing. So it wasn't really a black versus white movement either. Joe Slovo and his fellow conspiracists, they simply used blacks and black numbers to attain their ends. But you're talking about the demographic decline of whites in this country. Of course, in 1960, we were 20% of the population, and in the urban centers, we were actually in the majority. Another reason why we are also declining demographically is because of immigration. Over the last 20 years, population of this country has actually doubled, thanks to population growth, but also to unbridled immigration, especially due to the economic collapse of Zimbabwe. Almost half of that country's population has simply streamed over our borders. So, you know, there's also a parallel there with what's happening elsewhere in the Western world, in Europe and in North America, where constantly immigration is being encouraged and people are also saying it's a good thing and it's going to lead to economic growth and so on. No, I mean, ultimately you just end up with, huge numbers of almost unemployable people in your country, and they actually consume your resources in the form of water, schooling, health services, and so on. I mean, the health services in South Africa have virtually collapsed. And in the 1970s, we were about first in the world. We had tremendously good health services in this country for all races, including for blacks. And all of that has now collapsed as a result of unbridled immigration.
How familiar does this sound to you, Raleigh?
Well, I know, and I'm so glad you had suggested it for that reason. Dan, I assume that they've gone to some type of socialized medicine in South Africa?
Well, yes. We've got a two-tier system. There's the state system, which is increasingly dysfunctional, you know, and in fact, people are saying that people are being killed in the hospitals, and we've investigated quite a few stories where people were simply left to die in state hospitals, contrary to the all medical ethics and so on. But there's still a private medical sector serving about 7% of the population, but they're now talking about actually nationalizing that or forcing the private sector into a so-called state health system, more or less along the lines of the British one. So I think we're only a few years from a total collapse in the medical field.
And that's what we're seeing here, too. What's starting out as Obamacare, you can already tell, will end up as single-payer socialized medicine. And I'd be surprised if that doesn't happen there as well. Any other questions, Carl?
Yeah, just very quickly, Dan, and I'll get off the phone. Two things. One, very quickly, Orania, how's that project going? And two, just to play devil's advocate, and I'll get off the phone and listen to you, but I would like to hear you, and again, play devil's advocate, defend apartheid. I mean, I would say apartheid, I mean, I don't think the average American realizes that apartheid simply meant apart, and the problem, I think, was that 12% of the population could simply not afford to take care of 100% of the population, and that's really what the problem was. That's what the desire to be apart was all about.
Well, I'll add that apart wasn't the only problem. The problem was apart but unequal. If it was apart but equal resources, I don't think there would have been the outrage. The problem that I have with apartheid is that it's very obvious that it could easily be seized upon to get where we are now.
I don't understand what you meant by that.
What I mean by that is that the Marxists and the game players and all the people who sell us the fairy tales, a system like that is all they need to come in and take over.
Well, all right. Well, and that's exactly what's happened.
Yeah, and that it was like candy to a baby on that, and that's why I bristle at the thought of it. But I'm not there. So that's a great question, Carl, and we'll have Dan answer it. Thanks.
Okay, I'll get off. Thanks. Bye.
So if you had to look back to the days, and of course apartheid has been not only painted with a horrible brush in the past, but very recently one of the articles that you wrote, you lambasted the BBC, and rightfully so, because, again, I wouldn't defend separatism, but the way they painted it made it out to be something it wasn't.
Yes, exactly. You know, ultimately, of course, these are very complex issues, and South African history is very complex, but you could trace apartheid back to the First World War, or the end of the First World War, and Woodrow Wilson's doctrine of self-determination. You know, he made that speech in Congress about the 14 points that should henceforth you know, be internationally applied, and one of them being the self-determination of peoples. And, you know, the people here, people like Verwoerd and so on, they simply applied Woodrow Wilson's principles, sometimes imperfectly, but then you must realize, you know, we don't have unlimited resources in this country, coupled with a very high population growth. So that ultimately, I think more than anything else, that torpedoed the system, just like it's torpedoing this system.
Mm-hmm.
So the social conditions in South Africa are such that it's not conducive to any form of a system, whether it's apartheid, liberal democracy, communism, or whatever you're going to apply in this country. But recently, my thinking around this issue has been that, for me, it's more of a conceptual and civilizational problem that you are being confronted with. And actually keeping systems apart is not a bad thing. You know, it's like mixing Christianity and Islam, or mixing Christianity and Buddhism and so on. You end up with a sort of a syncretistic system. And that's what we've got in South Africa now. We've got neither a Western nor an African system. And in a way, we're getting the worst of both worlds. You know, the African system is not too bad for Africans because it normally, people are fairly disciplined in that the chief has got absolute power, and he sees to it that, you know, his subjects are controlled in various ways so that they don't simply go out and rob and pillage as they are doing at present. I mean, there are large parts of traditional Africa that are fairly safe, and in this country too, say in the 1950s, you could go into certain tribal areas, even a single white woman could go there, and she would be relatively safe, whereas today, I mean, you can barely walk the streets without some mayhem bursting loose, you know, and especially with dangers towards women and children and so on. So we have to rethink all of these issues again, and the multicultural system and theory is inherently flawed, and it's going to fail worldwide as it is. You know,
right.
Mrs. Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, she stated a year or two ago that multiculturalism had failed in Germany. And I think we have to acknowledge that. And it's got to be back to the drawing board, and we have to rethink how we should order our societies. And the thinking here around keeping different systems, social systems and cultural systems separate from one another is not a bad idea. I mean, it's even, in a way, scientific. I've just read a little book about, you know, the famous philosopher of science, Thomas Kuhn, whom I used to study also in my young days at university. But part of the whole paradigm idea is that each paradigm is a worldview unto itself. And there's such a thing as the Western paradigm, and there's such a thing as the African paradigm. You know, Africans believe in the ancestors. They practice. Now, in South Africa, you have the absurd situation where you can actually go to a witch doctor and get a medical prescription from him or her. Now, how can you place Western medicine founded on a scientific paradigm on the same level as somebody who deals in rituals and sort of what we consider to be irrational belief systems, magic, and so on, and treat them exactly the same way, and also allow people to be booked off work by the witch doctor. So, you know, multiculturalism leads to tremendous absurdities. I mean, segregation itself in the past, I remember there was always the annual question asked by the liberal Mrs. Sussman in Parliament, how many people had actually changed their racial classification in a year, and there were a few hundred, some mixed-race person marrying an Indian and then becoming Indian or whatever, because they wanted to keep the system logical, and it led to this kind of these sorts of absurdities. But I think those absurdities were fairly light in relation to the absurdities of multiculturalism that we are experiencing at the moment. And you know, it's simply laughable.
Well, the problem with multiculturalism is it violates standard human nature. We're trying to legislate human nature. And we saw that here when we built the first government housing, Cabrini Green, in Chicago, and brought people from all different sociological and cultural differences together under one roof. And, of course, the crime went through the roof. They hated each other. Again, I am not for legislating anybody should be separate, but I think that if you go back to federalism, go back to local governments, that people will seek their comfort level on their own. You don't need laws or rules for that. But again, if you're seeking to control, if that's your goal, this is golden, because multiculturalism will guarantee that people will fight amongst themselves, and then the people whose names and faces we don't know, they'll take over. And I suspect that's exactly where you are now, Dan, and I suspect that's where we are going.
Exactly. Well, you know, the mayor of Chicago, Mr. Rahm Emanuel, I think when he was still one of Clinton's advisors, he said, never let a good crisis go to waste. And, you know, multiculturalism is creating an almost permanent crisis, which then enables government and the centralist bureaucrats to step in and to control people. Exactly as you say.
Yeah. That's the goal. And sadly, the media, the talking heads, the education organizations, the colleges are all on board with this. And we could debate forever. But my final question, because you were there before, you were there during, and you're there now, which is really still during. But if you could go back to before things changed, is there anything that could have been done to prevent what is really the globalists taking over?
Yes, definitely. I think so. You know, I think we would have had evolutionary change then instead of revolutionary change.
Oh, sure. But could it have been done? In other words, I understand conceptually how it should have been done. But given the reality of what we're dealing with here, do you think that had people been more aware at that moment that they could have successfully fought it? That's really my question.
Yes, definitely. I think we could have successfully fought it. You know, we had a tremendous army here that was about the fourth most powerful in the world, and we had a financial system, and we even had the oil from coal plants and so on. You know, we were relatively self-sufficient and not dependent on the rest of the world. We were a net food exporter. So this society could have evolved in its own way towards a much more successful system than we've got at the moment. But, you know, the globalists decided that South Africa had to go through this revolution, which we're going through now, and it's not finished yet, because the next step will be to actually nationalize the land, and that's going to be catastrophic for us.
Yes, it will. So with that in mind, and with how far they've come with their dastardly plans, is there any way to stop it now?
Well, I think there is. You know, if only we can rally together and stand together as a people in South Africa, talking specifically about the Afrikaners, I think we could stop the current process, and we could find allies among the more moderate and traditionalist blacks, because even though you know, the revolution has been going on for 20 years, in the rural areas, you know, blacks are still living like they used to 100 or 200 years ago, and with exactly the same customs and belief systems and so on. So, and we understand those, and we, you know, we've always had black allies inside the country, and there could be a realignment of politics in South Africa. But unfortunately, I think until now, our leaders have just been too stupid. You know, ever since the late 80s, we've had successive generations of leaders who were very opportunistic and with lacking in insight, and they're also not aware of all these global issues that we've been talking about. And that's why we find ourselves in dire straits at the moment. But it could change, definitely. And you know, because we are confronted with this almost daily crisis in South Africa, I find that more and more people here are becoming very aware and critical, and there's a lot of ferment and thinking going on in South Africa. And I think we could also spark off a kind of a global debate on these issues.
Gosh,
so
I hope
so.
We
could play a very positive role also in the rest of the world.
That would be a wonderful upside. You know, we talk a lot about these things, but for most of us, we don't have all that much personal skin in the game. You have put your whole livelihood into this and have been rewarded with the kind of lawsuits where you could be left entirely penniless. And I thank you for that kind of courage. I'm going to put a link up to all the sites, to your personal site and to Prague and some of your writings. And hopefully we can stay in touch. And I sure wish you the best, and you have my gratitude for getting the word out.
Well, thank you very much, Rolly. I really appreciate the exposure on your show, and the goodwill that you are expressing towards us. It's really much appreciated. And if you know the kind of intensity of what we are dealing with here in South Africa, it's almost like a daily cultural war and sometimes also a real-life war, in that there are casualties all the time and horrendous violent incidents taking place.
On every level, and what is there now absolutely is what is coming here unless we make those changes. So we'll stay in touch.
Definitely.
Okay, thanks, Dan.
Thank you, Rolly.